Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Stargirl Squadcast. I'm Cameron.
And I'm Tam.
And today we are once again missing a diva who is being a good little student and studying for a test. Boo. So sorry about that. But today we are going to be discussing season 3, episode 3, Frenemies, the Blackmail. I said that weirdly. It's okay. These chapters are chunky in their naming.
They are indeed. It's like Stargirl, Frenemies, chapter 3, the Blackmail.
It's too much. It's way too long. But yeah, so this was this episode when it was airing was probably, it was a crazy experience.
Indeed it was. It was quite a chaotic time for us, Tam and Cams.
There was so many times during this episode where I was like, this episode was written for me. I was like, yeah, yep, that's great. Like, I feel like I'm allowed to be this positive about it because I have been very critical is the word. I've been very critical of like season 2, for example. So I feel like I'm allowed to be this excited about it.
Of course.
I'm not like sucking up or anything. Like, I genuinely like this episode was a good soup, if you will.
For me too, like, I'm genuinely a positive and optimistic person, and I knew I was gonna have fun. And I understand how stories work, in which it takes time to develop, you know, a specific theme and to set characters and to set the tone and whatnot. And this episode for me is like the true start.
Yes.
In which case, the first episodes 1 and 2 was the setup for Starman. But in a similar way, they did that already in season 1, in which episodes 1 and 2 was the setup for Courtney and Pat, right? So, like, I'm not really surprised that this is how it's working. Like, I know that we don't know how the rest of the season is going to play out, but just based off of this alone, you really start to see the mechanics of all the dynamics and, like, all the pieces.
Right, right.
So that's what makes it very exciting. So yeah, like, I'm excited too.
But so let's just jump into the actual episode at hand. Obviously, the episode starts with Sylvester doing his little walkthrough of Blue Valley, where he's finding balance, supposedly. We know that that's pretty short-lived. It's really, really convenient of him for him to have parked on the side of the street that has the coffee mural and not the Jordan McKent mural, because I'm sure that would not have been. Although, does he know Jordan's identity? Would Pat have told him? I feel like that would add complications to Courtney's personal life that Pat like knows and is like, I'll let this one slide. But even still, it would not be great if he recognized that that was who that mural was dedicated to.
Yeah, that's kind of wild. But we have the scene where the grandparents, I'm looking at it right now, the grandparents, they know Starman. They know Sylvester.
They do. So he didn't wear a mask. So
yeah, he was also a child star.
Right,
so I'm
right.
sure they knew who he was. Like, this,
right.
this, that's actually a very important part of Sylvester that I feel like we don't really actually acknowledge, is that he has a huge ego because he has always been a star his entire life.
A star man.
That's why he's star man, because he thinks he's the center of the show. That's how everyone has treated him his entire life. Like, that's who he is. And that's actually really interesting, because the way that he plays Starman kind of is like an act. Like, it kind of, like, sometimes to me it seems like he's acting, like Starman is this role.
It yeah, his interactions, like, especially with the Crocs, it's, later do feel
like he's like
very not they're kind of theatrical.
Theatrical,
like,
yeah.
It's very stereotypical superhero.
Three times in this episode he said, I'm Starman. And it sounds like the kind of role that you would have in an action film. Like, you'd be like, I'm Iron Man kind of thing, like a Tony Stark kind of thing. But the thing is, like, I think he kind of thinks that he is Tony Stark, but like in real life.
I would not go that
with
far,
all
but...
the stuff of Tony Stark, but I just mean in terms of I think he thinks in real life
he's
a superhero.
Hot. I can't say the word.
I know. He thinks that he's literally the best thing on earth. Everybody loves him.
He does.
That's the song from One Republic that I always say, yeah, this is what Sylvester thinks of himself.
Yeah. So he makes his way around town. He gets some coffee from Sonia Sato, apparently. I saw Stargirl Wiki say, and I also saw it in the credits. And I was like, I remember that name, but I don't remember why that I remember that name. And then Stargirl Wiki pointed out that that's Judo Master. So I don't know if they're going anywhere with that, but they just very casually, the Judo Master is living in Stars Hollow.
No, wrong show, Bessie.
Blue Valley. And anyway, he spits out that coffee. He goes into the diner, and Yolanda is there working her shift
in the morning.
Very early shift for her. Yeah. I that diner must be open like 20. No, we've established that the diner is open 24 hours. So she really must have had like a 4 a.m. shift, 4 to 7 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts talking up with Sylvester, and this is not good. I didn't feel great about it. Yolanda is, she really is like pro Sylvester. Like you tell from this conversation, she loves that he's telling her about Ted Grant and how Ted Grant would
sucking
love
up to
her.
Him and he mm-hmm. is taking you can tell that he's like, ah, yes, this kid appreciates me. But he didn't even remember her name, which is like.
I don't think so. That's not how I interpreted the conversation.
No, for me, he clearly looked at her name tag and was like, oh yeah, you're Wildcat. Like, but like, it took him a moment. Like,
perhaps.
For me, that's how it looks like to me, like a lot. Like,
I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the fact that they're having this conversation, I think, is really going to come back to us later, obviously, when we are at that stage of. Or perspective stage. I honestly can't remember how much of this I've talked about on this podcast versus on just various social media platforms. But my main hypothesis for how this season is going to run, and Tam's as well, is that at some point there's going to be some schism that pits the JSA against Courtney, and therefore Infinity Inc. being... you know, Rick and Beth and Yolanda and Sylvester versus Courtney and whoever else ends up being on her side. Presumably also Jenny and Todd. Well, maybe just Jenny on the side of Infinity Inc. But regardless, so you can see that if that is
Courtney
indeed...
and Cameron, I think it's just going to be Courtney and Cameron on the other side. Maybe Artemis. Don't know.
Sure.
Don't know.
But yeah, so you can clearly see that they're planting those seeds, though, that Yolanda is, you know, gonna be open to working with Sylvester. And we see, if you haven't seen the stills for next week's episode, which have come out as of recording, so that's always nice to have. Please continue releasing stills on Fridays, CWPRT.
Preferably Thursdays, but yeah.
Or Thursdays, yeah. But... you can tell that Rick and Yolanda are going to be open to working with him further. So, you know, just things to point out. But yeah, so after we have that scene, we cut over to Courtney, who has prepared breakfast as a way of making amends to her family because, you know, she ditched school. She's annoyed that Mike is pointing it out, but it seems like Pat and Barbara have mostly forgiven her at this point. So... that's nice of them, I guess. But of course, their breakfast is interrupted when the Crocs come in. And I don't know how I felt about this scene. I think it's fun that they included it, but like, it didn't really go anywhere. If that makes sense
to me, like, I think they added it in because it showed that they were still
around.
Friends, and they were around, and they wanted to be friends with
them. And they're still breaking into the house and whatnot.
So that when at the end, when they're fighting, like, it shows that, well, the Crocs, you know, don't have anything against Pat specifically or his family.
Okay.
Like, they're still, But I don't know. For me personally, there's a little bit of a lack of Artemis, there's always a little bit of a lack of Artemis.
Yeah, but I think they could use Artemis in ways that aren't just necessarily shadowing her parents, but it's fine.
It's fine for now. But I really enjoyed the fact that, like, Artemis fully, like, dragged her seat right up next to Courtney and, like, smiling, like, let's go. Like, yeah. You could, like, she really wants... I guess I find the dynamic, and we can mention it a little bit later when we see her again in the episode, but I find the dynamic that Artemis has with the JSA and Courtney particularly interesting, because she's the only one who actually has friends outside of the JSA. Yes. So it's like, yes. This isn't like... Like, Artemis doesn't need the JSA as a friendship group. She wants it to be part of something bigger, right? And this is post the fact that she got rejected from the whole football career thing that she really, really was aiming for in season two. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like Artemis is actually pretty balanced in the terms of having connections and having friendships with her team members at school. So... It makes it even like cuter that she actually still wants to be Courtney's friend, like as her neighbor, which I think it's sweet. Kind of reminds me of, I guess, Paula's relationship with Barbara a little bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
less a little intense.
But then we cut over to Beth and Rick that are in Rick's car. Rick is driving Beth to school, which is a fun development. Beth is mid-conversation with her mother, specifically, just her mother.
Who's at work and her scrubs and everything.
Yeah, she's in her scrubs. And then she adds her father to the call, and the little graphic that's just like, dad has been added to the call.
Yeah.
I think is cute.
I love what her dad says when he gets added. He's like, is this about the gambler? Is this about gambler? And he's like, oh, I knew
he's
that
invested.
Guy.
He's invested.
Yeah, he was like, I knew that guy was weird when I was working with him, which I love to hear that.
Oh, I didn't even recognize
that.
Yeah,
he does say that. Which is, he's like, I can't believe I was working with supervillains. I knew that guy was weird when I was working with him. Yeah.
That's fun. Obviously, so Beth hangs up on her parents. She fully hangs up on them. They're like still talking to her. She's like, I'm not dealing
with
this.
She's like, goodbye.
Bye. And Rick is, he has like this face, like it's not pride, I don't think, but he's very happy for Beth that she does get to have this positive relationship with her parents in general, but also the fact that they're so supportive.
I think he's amused by the situation. Like, not amused is also not necessarily the best word. He's entertained. I think he's entertained.
Sure. Okay.
By
yeah, that works. That works is the right
he's
word.
He's also, remember, he was the one who was there for her all of last year. Well, last summer. Where
right,
she really
she...
honestly thought that her family was breaking apart, right?
And she wouldn't have a support system.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So he's happy for her that they're clearly, according to him, things are way better now than they were before when she was crying, you know, like coming to him crying over what was happening. So.
Right. There also is the development very shortly thereafter that Rick has been living in his house with nobody. Matt is gone. He's just been living by himself, which is what I predicted.
Yeah, me too.
Because I felt like they couldn't have like...
It's an abusive.
I feel like they couldn't
so...
have easily gotten out of the Matt storyline. So I think this is like the they were just like, it's fine, he's gone. Now the question really is, are they going to mention this ever again, or are they just
going
to drop it?
I really
because it
hope
feels
they
like
do.
Something that they're going to drop.
But he's
like
still
it's
a
just
child.
Like a throwaway line to know. I know.
The thing is,
I'm aware.
I know you're aware. But the thing is, for all the kids who are left alone, okay, we have Jenny, we have Cindy. We have Isaac and we have Artemis. Cindy is the only one, and it's because she's who she is, who's able to get away with what she's been doing as being an orphan, okay? But Isaac and Artemis, like, they were thrown into the foster care system after what had happened to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny also, she clearly was in the foster system. Now she's out because she's 18. But for Rick, I'm like, this show really does go through the pains of placing kids who now have nobody with somebody else, not just leaving them all alone, unless you're Cindy Berman. But that's different because she's Cindy. But
right. But
Cindy still has the trauma of being by herself. So to me, to just let Rick have absolutely like no contextual help of like putting him some, like at least some place to stay, or mentioning like, oh, he can stay here or he can stay there, or like how, stuff like how does he pay for his gas, how does he pay for his food and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, because he doesn't have a job.
He doesn't have a job. However, like,
unless he's still selling alcohol.
I don't know, but in season one they made it explicitly clear that the way he made money was by selling the alcohol, and we don't know if he's still doing that, and I feel like he wouldn't, but if he's stuck in a situation, maybe he has to go back to that, and maybe later Cameron's gonna see him doing that. Don't know, like who knows, right? But like, these are all options that they can take, and it's like, I feel like we, like, on one hand, sure, we can just, like, gloss over it, but Rick is one of the core four JSA members. Like, I feel like it's not fair that he's going through all of this, like, neglect and abuse, and they're not trying to help him at this point.
Yeah, I think
it's rough.
If it's brought up again, they'll obviously get into it more, but if it's just going to be a peripheral thing, then unfortunately they're just not, but they're gonna pretend like everything is fine.
The thing is though, because he told, by telling Beth, this is now a secret that Beth is holding for him if she doesn't tell anybody else. And sure, while the last secret he told her just last episode about the whole hourglass situation, that I can understand her keeping.
Yes.
For someone who truly cares about Rick, and she was going to say something.
She would probably tell her parents.
Yes, I was going to say, I feel like she's going to tell a responsible adult, because she was going to say something to him before she got cut off by the goggles, which we'll talk about in like a second. So I'm really curious what she was going to say.
Yeah.
She was concerned. I'm not sure. Like, she was concerned. Yes. That at the very least. So I don't know.
But yeah, so she is cut off by the goggles that make like a little ping sound that sounds like it's a Pokemon sound effect every time that I've heard it. I don't remember exactly what Pokemon sound effect it reminds me of. If you play Pokemon, let me know what I'm thinking of. But she gets a bunch of files that we know are coming from the gambler's laptop with Cindy, anonymously sent to her, although it's pretty clear. I feel like everybody knows that it's Cindy that sent the file, like almost immediately.
They don't at the time, but yeah.
They don't at this time, but by the time they get to school, I mean, Courtney pretty much figures it out. Anyway, so...
What I like about that is that you could see Rick is very concerned. He's like, who is sending this to you? Like, he's like, what is going on? Like, some weird hacker is now, like, communicating with you? Like, he was not impressed by that, which is fun because you just know it's Cindy.
But yeah, so, and then we cut over to Cindy, who is trying to crack into the Dragon King files on the gambler's computer, which
Wait, can we just stop?
What?
There is an ISA credit union, okay?
That's what?
So funny. I'm reading what it says on the
file. ISA credit union?
That's what it says. That's where, like, the $5 million, like, one of, I guess, some of the blackmail money or whatever.
This show is so ridiculous.
So it's Northport Savings and Loan, but the ISA Credit Union. So if you ever wanted to know how the ISA funds themselves, how Cindy can afford such expensive clothes, it's because she just got to put it on that ISA Credit Union.
This is where I out myself as not really being that good of an adult, because I don't fully know what a credit union is. But
you don't even have a credit card, so.
Okay, wow. come for me, Jesus. So anyway, Cindy, with the laptop, has been trying to get into Dragon King's files. The gambler has like this weird little, I don't, it's like a graphic,
it's like an avatar,
an audio that plays. Yeah, I don't even know how you would begin to set that up, but sure. That's taunting her the entire time that she can't get in. I'm intrigued as to what exactly the gambler would have on Dragon King that she can't find within Dragon King's own files. Because, I mean, I guess, like, the gambler,
like,
you could say he has, like
that,
all
that
of these backlogs
have
of, like, digital footprint or whatever. But,
yeah, but remember,
I don't know.
Okay,
remember
how the Dragon King was executed in quotation marks. Right? And that's
right.
A whole history that I feel like if you're Dragon King, you don't want to put that in any kind of records, because
sure.
Why would you want to have someone have access to that part of your history? I'm sure the gambler, who we know has blackmailed people before, very much could have information like that stored away. So maybe how he was able, maybe like the written report of like Dragon King's total transformation that I'm assuming must have happened in that execution room was written down somewhere, and then like Cindy maybe is looking for clues on how to help her own health based off of that. That's a very wild guess, but yeah.
So we cut over to Cindy at school, and Cindy is trying to act natural in front of Courtney's locker because she needs something from Courtney. But she doesn't want to make it so obvious.
No, but she really is pacing back and forth before Courtney.
No, I know. But I interpreted that as her having an ego and wanting to retain that ego and not wanting to make it seem like she needs something from Courtney Whitmore to the rest of the school. But she does need something from Courtney Whitmore, which is why she like leans up against the locker and like does a bunch of hand motions.
Maybe. I think it's also because she's annoyed about her day or whatever. But
sure. But so she talks to Courtney.
And we get to see what's in Courtney's locker.
If you want to go over that, you can. But
one interesting thing is that there is a picture that looks like it might be a young version of Mike with maybe his mother. Yeah.
No, it was Pat. So
there's one with Mike and Pat, but there's another one that looks like it could be Mike and there's a woman there.
Okay.
It's either that or it's a very blurry StarCat picture, but it's on top of the picture with Mike and Pat.
Courtney and Cindy are talking about how the gambler was found to be blackmailing somebody. Cindy's not surprised. Courtney is immediately suspicious of this. Cindy has a line that I really like how she delivered, which I think she says like, birds fly, fish swim, blackmail. Whatever.
It was great.
I liked that delivery. It was fun. But yeah, so she's very much like, Courtney shifts the conversation over to how Starman is taking the day off because he's finding balance. And Cindy immediately is like, what are you talking about?
No way.
Well, number one in that capacity, but number two, like, how are you, Courtney Whitmore, somebody who he should be following an example of for finding balance? Because, you're a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, Courtney takes offense to that. But
it's also this entire section of the conversation, she's half distracted because she noticed that Cameron walked by, so she's already half mentally checked out of the conversation, and you can see that Cindy is watching.
Well,
that.
I was also thinking that she still doesn't want him to potentially overhear.
Oh, I know, she doesn't want her to overhear, so she's nervous about what they're talking about. Like, yeah,
let's calm down. But so Cindy eventually leaves her alone. She walks over to Cameron. She's like, "Hey," and Cameron just closes locker and walks away.
And even when we get to see that locker, I laughed too. But even when we see that locker for a few seconds, there's no color in that locker. It's pure.
No, he had a blue flannel.
I'm talking about on his locker in terms of the stuff he put on the locker.
Sure, yeah,
it's
he just
all
had, like,
just black and white sketches.
Pencil sketches.
Yeah, there's no paint, no nothing like that. Yeah.
But yeah.
Also, they're not, because it's a new year, they're now across from each other, Courtney and Cameron's lockers. They're not next to
each
other anymore.
They used to be right next to each other, so.
Which is deliberate.
Yes, most likely.
Clearly, there is something that's happening with Camney this season in which, yes, Courtney likes Cameron. Yes, Cameron likes Courtney. But Hunter Sansone himself is like, this is a Romeo and Juliet story, okay? It's not gonna end well.
Yeah, it's not.
So it's like, we're excited.
It's very clear that they're not gonna work out.
It is clear to me,
it's
too.
It's like so obvious. But it's a nightmare. Like, if you're really invested in it, I'm not gonna be like, oh, you're stupid.
No, of course not. It's fun. But I'm like, oh, here it comes, and it's going to be a roller coaster. That's the thing. Yeah.
And I'm excited for that. I'm excited.
Oh,
I'm
the
excited
drama.
For some
I'm ready for that.
Some classic drama. Barbara is back at the American Dream. She is pulled into her office by Paula, who has been asked to fully join the Rotary Club. And after she baked apparently such an amazing German chocolate cake, And she's like, like,
"It
is a nightmare, Barbara.
It is a nightmare, Barbara."
Oh my God,
that's literally what you said.
Why did your mic do that?
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's how she said it. And then she's like, "Well, okay, well, talk about what they do. What do they do?"
I don't know what a Rotary Club does.
Me neither. I actually don't know. And she's like, I don't know.
I looked it up. It seems like they're just like general humanitarian question mark. But I can't really tell. It's like they're very vague. It's
okay.
Like we're helping starving children.
It's okay that you don't know, because most people don't know. That it is a tough question.
So Tim comes in. Tim T. Tattle, I think, is his name, which is ridiculous. He's a cartoon character. And I think that I do like his inclusion, but only if he's not in every single episode from this point on. Because, like, I thought it was ridiculous and absurd that he was in the last episode. This one, I felt like, okay, I don't know if I like this as much as I did last episode. Like, a whole thing where he's, like, coming in and he's, like...
But that's just terrible.
The thumb,
that's why
he's,
like, he deserved
down.
To get smacked for that.
It's,
like,
it was... this is a little too
it's
much.
It's a little too much comical. Yeah, it's actually over the top. You know,
it's not even comic. I don't even think that a comic would do that now.
No.
Nowadays. Maybe in, like,
the
1940s.
Comical,
like,
in terms of literally a comic. I meant like they were trying to be funny. And
sure.
It's like, the thing is, I think with a plot line like that, though, it's more impactful if it's actually like something that someone would actually do in 2022 in the workplace in real life. I don't think any man, I mean, maybe, in which case, good luck, Charlie, but I don't think anybody is actually going to do what he did with the thumb going from a thumbs up to a thumbs down one. But people down talk women in the workplace all the time. So it's like,
I will say, yeah. That a development from last episode to this episode, if I remember correctly, was last episode he was not her boss explicitly,
and
this episode he is.
Yeah.
So
I also think
clearly there was like some kind of rivalry where he has risen in power in one episode. So,
well, listen,
sure.
We knew that James Chappell was a project manager, and he got a raise between season one and two.
Right.
I'm curious if this man somehow like also messed with James Chappell's position and kind of like tried to trample over him to get like the highest position he could, and there
perhaps
actually is draw, in which case then
see I always saw the workplace hierarchy as James being higher than Barbara to begin with.
Me too. I
and
thought
so
that too.
I still think it's James and then probably Tim on maybe
but
the
I
same
can't
level.
Imagine James letting, because James would then have oversight over this guy Tim. So to me, it's a little bit, because I don't see James allowing him to be on his team in a way that he would.
Well,
know.
They might be in
he's
two separate departments. I don't know.
No, I don't think so, because they are together in the same boardroom meetings all the time and stuff like that.
But we cut over to Pat and Sylvester and Zeke, who has returned.
This is the most boring scene for me in this episode, and it's not even that boring.
The thing that I liked about it. I don't really care about the Sylvester finding a job plotline, whatever. But what I did think was funny was Zeke says something like, "My mother abandoned me because I cried too loud."
Yeah.
And then and then Pat echoes,
He cried
too
loud. Yeah, I know. That like, was funny. I love like humor like this on this show. Like
it's like that's stupid. I love it.
I know.
Give me more of that level of stupid instead of Tim T. Tattle. Just let it be. But this scene in general is just a huge cheese fest. I don't really have that much to say on it though. There's really not.
Whatever.
That much.
It
I don't
is
think.
What it is.
I will
it's
say
how he found
that
out.
He has.
It was how he found out, because he opened the newspaper and saw Rip City opened and like the Crocs, right? So like that's how he knew.
I don't know if that's how he found out, because they're next door neighbors or like across the street neighbors.
Perhaps, but I thought that like he was like, oh, they actually have business here. They're like doing stuff here and whatever. Maybe I'm totally wrong. But
I really liked the ad that they actually had for Ripped City. Don't be a wimp.
Yeah.
And then, like, the little speech bubble that's over Crusher where he's like, let's get going. I just...
You can picture it so well.
It's like, such a cheesy little small town newspaper thing. I love it.
And I can imagine Crusher on the phone with the newspaper explaining how he wants this ad to look.
Okay, yeah, give me like with Comic Sans speech bubble.
Yeah, and I have to be saying something cool, like "Let's get going" or "Time to get ripped" or whatever.
So we go back over to the cafeteria of Blue Valley High School, where the gang is talking about everything. Cindy is included this time from the get-go. They have five chairs at that table, and Beth. Says to the group.
Oh, the Irwin Hassan thing.
Yeah, I wasn't going to remember the name, but yeah. So the gambler was blackmailing the Kroc family, and he repaid them. I think they established that they repaid him shortly before the gambler died. So obviously that puts suspicion on the Crocs. And while everybody else is kind of like, yes, let's go after the Crocs, Courtney's like, well, let's keep in mind Artemis and her feelings.
I loved,
because we don't want to take away her parents.
I loved the
from
direction
her.
Of that scene. Mm-hmm. And it just cuts to Artemis having the time of her life with her
She's so happy.
It's so sweet. Like, I actually, like, this is such a wholesome scene. Like, I just, yeah. Also, I have to mention, because I didn't mention it before, Beth's outfit is a 10 on 10. And I really, really wish I knew what her pins were. Actually said all the necklaces, the pins, the strawberry skirt, the earrings, but she has two pins, and I went to a house and I don't know what the house is. It might be her own house. I really wish I knew what it was. And another one, it looks like it's a Black Lives Matter pin. I don't know. It could be like, it looks like a fist to me. When Courtney says, well, okay, this is what we're gonna do,
the Russian,
we're not gonna rush in, and Beth goes, like you. And then Courtney goes, no, like how Sylvester did with the shade. And just that and everything about that interaction.
I like that Courtney feels the need to separate herself from Sylvester, because already you can see that she's kind of jaded with him. Like, even though in the last episode they were like trading, not secrets, but like skill sets or whatever.
We have
the same like power set or whatever, but like, and this basically the same costume, but like, we are very different
people. Yeah, he's not my dad. Like, definitely not now. Where before, it's such a different, it's so funny when you think of season one Courtney and you think of this Courtney right now, how absolutely
character development
opposed they are. Yeah. But what I really like about this is Beth's comment, okay? Because as we know so far, Beth is team peacekeeper between the people who are like, oh yeah, everyone's got an issue, and we're going to like make false accusations out of everywhere, even if we don't have proof, because people are who they are based off of who they came from. And then their side, like Courtney's side, which is like, oh, we're giving everybody a second chance. That's how it works. And right away, you have Beth say something that slightly offends Courtney, because Courtney was not talking about herself. And Beth immediately went, oh, that just sounds like just like you. Like, you rush in, right? And she wasn't saying that to be mean. She was saying that as like matter-of-factly, right? And I think that's like the first seed planted that even though Courtney and Beth are on the same side,
specifically, yeah.
Yeah, that even though Courtney and Beth are on the same side, that doesn't mean that Beth agrees with everything that Courtney's going to be doing, like upcoming. And the same thing that I don't think Courtney is going to necessarily, I think Courtney's going to be surprised. I think, because you see her surprise when Beth says this, and I think it's foreshadowing that, again, at some point, Courtney's going to be surprised that Beth is going to maybe not agree with her on certain things.
We cut on over to a little bit later in the school day, presumably right when school is like finished for the day, like the end of the last block of classes. Cameron is in Miss Wood's class. He is stopped behind. He's like, held back, that's the right word, because he hasn't been turning in his assignments, which makes me wonder, is he able to write, or is it specifically the painting that's freezing up, or can that boy not leave any mark without like experiencing immense pain?
No, I think he's straight up just not doing his schoolwork.
Okay.
I think he's upset So he's just like, right. I'm not okay. writing an essay right now. I mean, maybe, who knows? Maybe he accidentally froze his computer the night before and something like that. Like he was trying to type up an essay or whatever and it didn't work. But
he could afford to get a new one, yeah.
Yeah, he could, but maybe not overnight if it was due the day before, right?
Sure.
So who knows? Also, but all of the clocks on
I know
this
you
one's desk.
Love bringing up.
I love yeah. bringing it up. That's all I'm going
to
say.
The detail about this scene that I want to bring up is the no bullying allowed.
Oh, yeah.
Sign, which isn't abnormal for a school to have, but particularly for this scene. Because my sequence of events in watching this scene, okay, as somebody who I feel like I'm very vocal about it on, again, when I speak online, I feel like we've only really talked about it like once or twice on this actual podcast.
We did talk about it for a while.
We did talk about it for a while. I listened back because I wanted to know like what parts we talked about and what parts we didn't, so I wouldn't get redundant. And we talked about a 30-second scene for 13 minutes, which is crazy. The dynamics between Cameron and Rick in the comics I really like. So I like that they are doing something with them in this show. And it's so fun how much they hate each other for no reason.
So when
I saw this scene happening, I was like, okay, so we're going to get like Ice Hour parallels, whatever. Sure, that's fun. And then I heard Rick's voice. And I think I literally screamed. There was so much that, like, if at like 8:25 p.m. if you were in the New York City area and you just like the mood shifted wherever you are, that's because I was screaming, crying, and throwing up.
Cam
watching my
blacked
television
out, like,
screen.
Fully. She just ascended and has not come back.
I did ascend. Tam cried.
I cried. But in my defense, I cry when I get very excited about and very emotional about my excitement on TV. It's embarrassing, but I did.
We were generally speaking unwell. But yes, so Cameron yells at Miss Woods when she's just trying to stick out for him and be like, I understand when things are bad at home or whatever. He yells at her. Rick comes in and is like, don't be a jerk. And
they escalate it so much.
It's so... So Cameron does apologize.
He does
because
apologize.
I think he does genuinely... Like, he didn't mean for that outburst to come out like that. Whatever. And then Rick just...
I don't think he didn't mean it. I think he didn't expect to be caught. I think he was shamed by difference of opinion.
Yeah. But...
That's fine. But yeah.
As he's trying to leave, obviously, Rick shoulder checks him.
Oof.
And like... The two of them are having a glare off. Miss Woods is like, I am uncomfortable by the energy that he brought into the studio
yes,
today.
Yes, yes. That's exactly what happened.
As Rick and Cameron just like,
they enter a Sonic versus Mario in the Olympic Games kind of battle before a sport where it's like... Sonic versus Shadow.
Okay.
If you get it, you know what I'm talking about.
The thing that struck me most, because I've seen, not only, I've watched this scene a couple times, but I've also seen it a lot on social media, because I think that this was not, this was a very big thing on the internet for this episode. But I noticed the lighting that they chose for the scene, because when I was watching it initially, I was like, oh, the lighting for Rick specifically is really good. Like he's lit up very well. Like I like what they were doing with that. And then it like clicked for me that the reason why it stands out so much is because they have Cameron in shadow.
Yes.
And so you get to see that not only are they in like, this kind of like opposing force, literally like they are opposed to each other, but you can see that one is on the side of light and
light.
One is on the side,
of,
on
the
darkness,
side of darkness,
whatever.
Yeah,
and like I like that.
I like it too. The few things that I have to say about this is that number one, there's the theme, the Hourman theme that they play. Yes. And it sounds like it's like the second,
it's a little spooky.
It's second that the camera pans and you see that Rick is in the doorway, they bring the Hourman theme, but they slow it down and they add like the typical like sounds that you associate with like winter soundtrack music. Like very,
I would say
slow.
it sounds kind of horror movie-ish.
I would say to me it sounds a little bit like a winter scene. Like it does sound like it got frozen over. Like it's being like stretched out. But also it is scary. Like it's intimidating. It's like our man. It's not like the tinkly tinkly cuteness like that you're used to hearing. It's
not whimsical and discovering. Yeah, it's threatening.
It's threatening. Yeah, it's threatening. And I think the other thing is that, and I mentioned this in our last Ice Hour discussion and for episode 5 of season 2, I knew, right? Like, I knew that when we have him here and he actually insults Cameron and says, well, you're a spoiled rich kid, right? And that's the insult that comes in. First of all, after getting the context that we know that Rick's all by himself, he has nobody. We don't even know what his living situation is like right now. Like, you know that that hurts him, right? Because it's like, this is someone who he sees has the luxury to, like, spend his entire summer putting paint on a mural about his father. The father who literally killed his parents through Grundy, right? Like, all of this mess. But that said, in season 2, he had no reason to go after him. He hated him, but he had no reason to go after him.
Yes.
All it took was for Rick to witness this one mean thing that he said to Miss Woods for him to now actually have dirt on this boy, which is crazy because it's so inconsequential.
He's jumping on it.
He's jumping on it. And then he's threatening him. And like the threat that they have,
it's such an insane threat.
It's
for
crazy for what had gone down.
He was an angsty teenager doing angsty teenage things. Nothing that Rick has not done before.
Absolutely not. And yet. It's bad enough that Rick
is basically like I'm gonna kill you.
He basically told him he was going to die. So, everyone in this room except for Miss Woods is going to die.
It's just
not you, Miss Woods. I love you. Keep doing your teachery stuff. But you're going to die.
But then, you know,
you have the special line.
Cool.
You go.
Yeah, cool.
To me, I thought that he knew, but
I did not.
You don't think he knew.
I did not. I think Rick chose that word and Cameron is laughing because he knows the double meaning of that word. I don't think Rick I don't think Rick did that intentionally.
No, I didn't
think
he
used it intentionally,
but I thought when he responded with, yeah, cool, that Rick picked it up. I don't think so.
I didn't see anything on Rick's face.
But his reaction is
after that signified.
True.
Yeah. So I just assumed that he was like, I hate that guy.
Yeah, what
so
I love
much.
So much is that after Cameron leaves and Miss Woods is like, hey, that was not an appropriate response to what had just transpired. He literally is like, okay. Like, he did not process, listen, and went in one ear, went right out of the other. He could not care less. He's like, oh, I'm doing that again. Thank you for
He's
the advice.
He's ready to do that again.
But I'm doing that as soon as I leave this classroom.
I'm also ready for that to happen again. But so and then you think that it's
you
over.
You think it's over, but it's
but
not
it is
over.
Not.
No.
So you cut back over to Cameron, who is walking outside in the parking lot. He is clearly still
mad.
He's still mad about everything that just transpired. He sees
because
Rick
won that
car.
Fight, by the way. That's why that argument.
Yeah,
so
sure. I mean, he didn't have any. There was no comeback. That
yeah,
he said.
Yeah.
So by
that's
default,
what I'm saying. So,
by,
yeah,
default,
by default,
Rick did win. Yeah.
He wouldn't be that mad. He wouldn't be that mad.
That's
if
true.
He knew if he thought that he left that room on the upper hand. He didn't leave the room on the upper hand. That's why he did what he did. But continue.
Sure. So he sees Rick's car. He looks both ways, make sure nobody's watching, and then he just like very nonchalantly just like pops that tire with an icicle. And I have several questions about that because so up until that point, I was led to believe that he had like zero control over this whatsoever. Right.
But clearly.
And it hurts him to like use it, and like he doesn't know what he's doing. So like clearly you see that he does have some kind of control over it. I also think that it is so satisfying that the canonical first time that he intentionally uses his powers is to spite Rick Tyler. That is so important to me. Stargirl writers, you have no idea.
Specifically with the car that last season, Rick revved for no reason. But Rick revved his car for no reason at him last season. And from Cameron's perspective, he didn't do anything to provoke or to
it's not from Cameron's perspective he didn't do anything. In season two he didn't do anything.
I know he didn't do anything. Exactly, he didn't do anything as far as we know, unless they have history from before that could be the situation. But assuming that he didn't do anything at all, which is literally how the story presents itself, then yeah, he's going after the thing that that car is literally Rick's baby. And it's, but the thing is, that's also like ingrained in the Our Man culture, right? Because it's like his dad said that car was the love of his life, and you can tell also now that car is the only thing that Rick actually cares about, that's like a material thing other than the hourglass itself. So just basically went out after everything that Rick cares about in that car.
But yeah, so you also see on his face after he does it that I can't exactly read it 100%. I kind of get the feeling that either it's not that he regrets what he did, but he more so can't believe that he actually did that, I guess, is how, because he certainly has some kind of reaction to what he did. But yeah. I don't know what exactly it is.
The thing is, for me, as he's walking up to see if anybody can see him, so it's not like a spur of a moment he saw it and he went, like, he was like I'm gonna do this, and I want to make sure no one sees me, and then I'm gonna do it. Because if it was Rick, he's not thinking stuff like that, he just acts impulsively,
right?
Cameron took the time, like at least 60 seconds before, to truly go, I'm gonna pop this guy's car with an icicle that's gonna come out of my hand, let me just around to see
what was the degree of intention though. Because, like, do you think that he was like, I'm going to summon something that is powerful enough to puncture this in one go?
Well, what else was he going to do? Throw a snowstorm on his little windshield? Like, what?
Well, does he know the extent of what he gets? Because
I'm sure.
I don't know. We don't know enough about what he knows.
But I'm sure he did, because otherwise, what is he doing that looks stupid? Going, ugh, at a car.
I mean,
like,
what? I mean, it's the same thing as, like, if you were to, like, if you were, like, a regular person and you don't like somebody, I haven't done this, but, like, if I was, like, an angsty teenage boy and I got in a fight, like, hitting their car, like, just, like, not, like, with a car, but, like, with your hand, like, just to, like, release anger out, like, I could get, I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't think so. But anyways, that's okay. I'll finally mention this school bus thing. So, like, that, I mean, you can you can characterize as what he did is basically that's like mischief, right? Like, he messed up with someone's car.
Yes, this is a crime. It's a crime. He's committing a crime.
And yes. The first time in Blue Valley that we see Icicle commit a crime, it is with a school bus. Not with the school bus. Yeah, it's with the school bus and the ice under the school bus, and then the school bus skidding out off of the bridge in episode 3.
Yes.
The first time Cameron...
Also in episode 3.
Also in episode 3 of season 1.
Stargirl.
The first time, the Icicle Jr. This is where that redundancy in media is like, oh, yes, you did that on purpose. I love you for doing that. But yeah, so anyways, on episode 3 of season 3, you have Icicle Jr. make his entrance just the same way with the school bus in the background.
I wouldn't say that he has earned his moniker yet, but yes.
Okay, but that's not my point. My point is that the first crimes happened in episode 3, and there's school buses.
School bus
yellow vehicles. The target of the crime, but there actually really is a school bus there. So it's like the parallels. Continue.
Anyway, now that we've spoken about
indeed
the ice hour for 20 minutes,
we get to the point where Sylvester and then Cindy's at the door, and Cindy is like, hey, you got left out of information that I know you got left out of because I was at the meeting when they said let's not tell him. I also get left out of stuff. Let's be a team. Let's go and get the Crocs. And then,
and she's doing this to look good for the JSA.
Yeah.
Which obviously is not what happens. No. Because, I mean, it's bad on two counts, because not only does this make her look worse with the JSA, but Starman doesn't even have any interest in her. Starman is pulling a Yolanda or a Rick to some extent and being like, no, you are Dragon King's demon spawn.
Terrible.
And therefore, I'm not going to work with you surely because of that. So,
and he says that he trusts you her less than
less
he does
than,
the Shade or the Gambler, which is like, okay.
Which is crazy, because in the last episode he was like, I can't believe the Shade told me to murder somebody.
I know.
So like, it's Sylvester is very inconsistent.
And then he says that she has daddy issues and all this kind of stuff. Like,
right, throwing in a, he has like a weird line about like, be bullying. Careful with those shoes.
Yeah, he says basically like, you'll fall down the stairs. If you fall, it'd be like falling off an overpass. It's like, okay.
Weird.
Guess he doesn't like those stairs. But that's mean. That's rude.
But
like, he's bullying a child. And worse, Mike witnessed the bullying of the child.
Yes, Mike witnesses everything that's happening, where Sylvester gets the idea that he's going to hunt down the Crocs, and Mike is like, I'm gonna need to tell somebody about this.
And there we go, seamlessly into the next scene at the grocery store. Here we go, it's the big Croc fight. Croc versus Sylvester, Starman versus Tigress and Sportsmaster.
Yes, so I don't have a whole lot to say about it. The Crocs are being reasonable. There's some the exchanges that they have, Starman and the Crocs, I actually really like. And I dunk on Sylvester a lot. I think that basically everybody in the fandom is dunking on Sylvester a lot, because nobody really likes him, and that's fine. But I will give props to Joel McHale for some of his deliveries during this scene.
Oh, he's great.
We're like, so good. Like, when he's like, confess, that was a good one.
Yeah.
And then when Crusher is like, are you done? And he's like,
no.
Like, those were both such good deliveries that I really did like. But there's still like people in the store. Like, I can't believe that
he's doing this.
It's like 9 p.m. on the dot. He walks in with the staff.
What are walks you doing?
In while the store is still open with a giant glow stick.
Granted,
Blue Valley is so oblivious to everything that, like, I guess,
but
they were just like, I mean, there was a pig on a leash in this episode, so maybe they didn't think it was that weird.
No, but listen, so Sylvester comes from clearly a huge town, California, and the way he speaks about Blue Valley and the way he speaks about how he used to be Starman in this episode implies that he was in such a big city that he was freely allowed to walk around as Starman with no issues. And he's saying it's the size of Blue Valley that's causing him problems, which is hilarious, because it's like as if he's saying, well, if we were back home from my time, I could have clearly have walked into a grocery store and started a fight. Everyone knew who I was. I had my own Wikipedia page. Like, that's basically how he's speaking of his olden times as Starman, which is so ridiculous. I know, his olden times, whatever.
So
I love the teamwork, though, that, like, in the fighting that the Crocs
really
have.
Quickly before like before the actual fight starts, we do cut back over to the pit stop. Rick is late because he has a flat tire, or had a flat tire. There's really not that much time.
No, I love the direction of, like, the way that, like, Rick looks up at the loft, and then you have Courtney, and then you have Yolanda, and then you have Beth, like, all up here.
You have the girls popping up in order of their introduction.
Yeah, I love that.
And Courtney gets a call from Mike.
We can kind of gloss over the, like, actual grittiness of the fight. I really loved it. Highlights, when Crusher gets the bat, and he's like, oh, hi, little friend, and he brings the bat. That was fun. When both Crusher and Paula grab the staff together and they hold it together, like that shot, I liked that. When the lights went down and you knew that Sylvester was just not backing down, that's when it got really cool. Like,
well, I really liked the cue for
and he blew
the
up
score
half
that
the
they
store
have there.
He, with that
he did.
Like, what?
He did, but I like the music cue.
He blasts them out the window, and then he blows up a car in the parking lot, which is like you're a superhero, like, you're really, really, like, okay, fine. It's bad. But yeah, no, I liked the way that, you know, I wasn't scared that they were going to die or anything like that in this scene. Like, I was like, but I liked the way that you can see that they were not, like, they were fighting, but they weren't trying to kill Sylvester. They were upset with him, but he was trying to kill them. And so that's why when they're in the parking lot and they keep backing away, that's why they're like, okay, come on, like, we'll keep on the fight. But also, it was getting dangerous to the point, it's like, right. At what point do you allow this to go on? Like, at some point, were they going to have to actually legitimately, like stop and kill him? Like, were they going to have to make that decision? Like, it's interesting because they are so, like, the level of the attack is, like, I don't know. If you were a real superhero, at some point you would have said, okay, I won. Get out of town. You know? Or, like, go for your daughter next. Or whatever. I don't know. Whatever kind of threat that you would make.
I like the laser focus thing. What? That doesn't make sense. I like how the staff is, like, glowing.
Yes. No, the visual effects of the staff are just really good in the fight.
Sylvester is, like, walking towards them. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, It still makes me a little bit sad that the staff, I know I said it last time, but the staff has no morality in the sense of...
Yes, it just follows whatever you say.
Which makes me kind of sad because I feel like for how much that the actually, maybe that's interesting because we saw, remember in season one, how much the staff hated Icicle, that it actually went on its own to go and, like, bully the picture of Icicle and then go and find Icicle. Yeah. So, you know, maybe the staff
While Mike is
maybe the staff is actually more anti-ISA than Courtney anything else would ever actually think of ever. Don't know. But moving along, we have Pat show up, right? And the whole concept of Pat stopping this fight in a parking lot with Stripe, and it's been a while since we've seen, like, Stripe in action like that, like, for real. So that was nice to see. Yes. It parallels when he had to stop the JSA fight the Crocs, but here he's stopping his Starman from the, like, to help the Crocs. So it's, like, a nice parallel of how everything has changed, but it's still the same because before it was the JSA were getting themselves in a situation that, like, they shouldn't have been getting themselves into by themselves. And it's the same thing. Now it's Starman getting himself into a situation with the Crocs that he shouldn't have by himself. And Pat having to collect him up and basically, on both cases, act like, you know, like the dad rounding up the children and bringing them home.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so we cut back over once the fight has been de-escalated. Sylvester was not invited on the ride home.
He comes in later. Yourself. Yeah.
The Crocs basically explain everything at that point and are like, yeah, we were getting blackmailed. We're out of jail because of a legal loophole or whatever. We got all our money back, which was somewhat suspicious. We thought there was going to be some kind of other angle, but there wasn't any, and everything is cool now.
They said that the gambler returned their money and all that, which they only realized after he was dead, too, so it wasn't like this thing that was happening beforehand. Mm-hmm.
I wonder who else the gambler might have paid back, and if that's going to apply...
That would be interesting.
To anything.
That would be interesting. He never paid back the Shade, but maybe he was going to ask maybe he was going to tell the Shade, like, oh, I did this with the Crocs.
He was in the process of doing that shortly before he died.
Yeah, that's possible. Because we don't really know what that conversation really was between them. We still didn't get a 100% accurate one.
Right. But Sylvester summons Pat downstairs so he can yell at him in embarrassing.
Oh, yeah.
And Pat
basically schools
like,
him.
Yes, Pat is basically like, listen, you are in my house. I am not your number two. I am.
It's so true. He's literally in his house. Like, show some respect. You're living in my basement. His basement. Yeah. You have no job.
You are disrespecting myself and my family and my neighbors and my neighborhood in front of my daughter. You are not allowed to do that. And yeah. He goes into, you know, Courtney's trauma and whatnot, and tells Starman all about how, you know, the events of the first season where she was convinced that he's her real father.
Yeah.
And it's basically like, you need to be better for her. He does say that he needs to act like a father, which I disagree with. He just needs to act like a respectable member of society, he's not doing. He's not acting like an adult. He's acting like a teenager.
He's the one who said in the first episode, "Oh, welcome Star family," as if he is part of this family, right?
Yes.
So if he's going to give himself the title of being a part of this family, then he does then have to earn that in the way of not acting like a stranger, like, you know, in that sense. And at least owning up to the fact that you're going to have to be respectful to the people in this dynamic in order to, you know, think that you have the right to be in the inner bubble of it. Otherwise, you're just renting space. He's not even renting because he has no money. But otherwise, you're just renting space to someone who's living in your basement. You're not actually part of this family. You're just a friend of Pat's who's here.
Following day at school, you have the JSA back at lunch. They're obviously all mad at Cindy for causing this whole conundrum. Cindy is kind of like, she accepts her, not punishment, because she wasn't punished, but like, she accepts that everybody's kind of mad at her and is yelling at her. She recognizes that she was in the wrong, and she recognizes why she's in the wrong, which I think is really nice development her behalf.
Again, I love Beth's outfit in the scene, and I'm so sad that it's only in it for like 2 minutes.
Courtney tells her, she sets the line that if she does something like that again, that she will not be invited to remain on the team. She'll be kicked off. And you can tell that Courtney is pretty upset about even having to say that. Like, she's very frustrated. She didn't want to have to offer that ultimatum. She wanted to just blanketly say, Cindy, you're fine, you can stay on this team, whatever you want to do, it's totally up to you.
Which is like, I mean, that's not the best leadership anyways. So, you know, she did have to do that. But it took a lot out of her to do that. You could see it on her face. She literally, like, had a mini little breakdown. Yeah, she really freaked out after she said that, which is interesting for Courtney. I don't really see her have those kind of issues. Like, she didn't have problems like that with Henry or even with Cindy in the first season when she was, like, kind of thinking that she was enemy. So I'm surprised a little bit at how hard this is for her.
Yes.
I think maybe because she's scared of losing her friends, the way that she was the one that was left behind, you know, last season with everyone else got like targeted by Eclipso. And then she was the one at the very end. And I think, you know, it's a legitimate fear of hers. She wants to keep her friendship group together. But at the same time, you know, her decisions are what's really upsetting her friends. And if she's going to name herself the leader, she can't ignore that.
Yes. Also, really want to point out MVP of the episode, which is Yolanda eating that grape.
Oh, yeah.
That's important. I don't have anything else to say beyond that was great. That was grape. But so we cut over to Paula at the Rotary Club. She's giving her acceptance speech, women supporting women moment. Barbara walks in and is like,
you go, girl. My best friend. Yeah. That's my best friend. Yeah.
That's basically it with that scene. But it's nice that they have it.
Yeah, it's nice. And then we have the Cammy scene again.
Yes. So Cameron does apologize to Courtney. He also says that he's been a jerk to everybody, So I guess he's apparently been self-reflecting for the past 24 hours.
After Rick presumably, gave him I don't that know. We talk, have, and he was like, yeah,
he did listen a little bit.
Yeah, he did.
He was like, I was being a little bit, wasn't I?
Yes, a little bit.
A little bit much.
A little bit much.
And so he doesn't want to tell Courtney the extent of what is happening, which I appreciate because based off of the promotional materials that we had for this season, we really thought that he was going to right off the gate be like, I'm going to tell you everything. I love you so much, Courtney Whitmore.
Yeah. I love you. Here's my snowstorm. Let's have a blizzard together. Yeah,
like,
no.
Like, that's not actually what he's doing.
Glad, so, because that would
least,
be wild.
At least there's
not
some self-respect
crazy.
There. No, that would that would be insane. But you do at the very least see when Courtney's like, oh, what's wrong? He's like, well, I'm not ready to talk about it yet. And he looks at his hand and you see Courtney also look at his hand.
She does.
Which is important because that was a big critique of mine in 205 when he's like, I'm going to show you something weird, Courtney. That Courtney, it didn't look like Courtney at all was like, oh, the something weird is, I know what the something weird is. This time she's like, oh, I think I know what is wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to make that assumption because that would be a wild thing to
wild.
Just randomly accuse
Can you imagine?
Somebody
she's
of.
Like, oh, are you icing up? Yes. Like, excuse me?
He would leave the building.
He would be like, you're crazy. You should go back on your meds. More ice out of parallels. No, I'm kidding. He would never say that to her. But
no.
Not yet. No, but yeah, so then she, you know, Courtney is very forgiving in a way that's like, oh, you can see.
Like, you can see that she's ready.
She's
like,
ready
I can fix
to. Yeah. Oh, no, but it's in the promo for next episode. She's literally like, I can help you. Like, it's just replace help.
He does not want it.
I can
he
fix
does
you.
Not want it.
No.
That's also something that you have to learn as you grow up, is that sometimes people just don't want your help, and you should just respect that. Like, even if they're, like, you don't want to give up on people, but, like, sometimes you just got to be like, okay.
It's a hard lesson to learn. It's a really hard lesson to learn.
It's a hard lesson to learn. Sometimes you get blown across a room.
Oh, man.
Happened to my friend, my buddy Eric. But
yeah, so she does invite him on a walk, which they do go on.
We will get to.
Yeah, later.
But we do get the beginning of, like, the end. The beginning of the end, like the end of the episode. The number one thing that I took away from Sylvester sitting at the bed was not the fact that he wants to respect Courtney, which fine, whatever, he wants to be a better Starman or whatever, but he still keeps that staff directly next to his bed in a case. Like, you are doing nothing to say
he's not
that this is
himself.
Equally, like, you're not actually, this is performative.
I mean, they could have put the case in another room if they really wanted to, or, like, I mean, not really.
Right, like, put it in the, maybe not the living room, because then anybody who's walking into the house, so I guess maybe you do have to keep it in the basement, but, like, still next to his bed feels, like, a little bit much.
Right next to his bed is ownership. That's, yeah.
Right.
Especially when it used to hide under Courtney's bed. You know, before.
Yeah, it would regularly hide underneath there. It would, like, go wake her up in the morning and stuff.
And also, the fact that it's in a box actually contains the staff, when we know that the staff has the ability to move around and do its own thing. So,
well, it was in a box before, but, like, I guess
it was
mean,
a crate,
like, I think the
though,
top
but it
was
able,
open.
It was able to lift itself out of the crate if it really wanted to before.
In
this box, I'm not necessarily. It feels restrictive. You know, it feels performative because it's like a glass. It feels like. I don't know. It's an unhealthy relationship that man has with his staff. Not to say that the relationship that Courtney has with her staff is perfect either.
No, but it's
better. Way better. Way better than
but
what this guy has. Yeah.
But so then we cut back over to Cameron and Courtney. They've been apparently walking for a very, very, very long time and not saying anything is what my interpretation must have been. Because, like, it's dark out now.
Well, I thought they were going on their walk, like, after school, like at some
right,
later
but
point.
How? Yeah. Well, okay. But so they are walking past the diner. Courtney bumps into him.
Flirtation
versus harassment being Cameron getting bumped by Courtney versus Rick. Courtney tries to hold hands with him. You can see that Cameron is thinking about it for a second before he's like, actually, no, I am an ice monster.
I can't do this. I gotta go. Which is exactly the words that Courtney has said to him so many times as
well. I love a good abandonment parallel.
Abandonment.
Like, I'm sorry, they're not getting together. I'm sorry. But they're like last shots, I guess. So you have the grandparents. They're running out. I think this was just randomly included for a last minute. Oh, what if it's them? It's not them. No. And then we also get Sylvester, who's ready to go investigate the murder scene. We have Barbara. She's working on her proposal. We have Paula, who's threatening Tim. Whatever.
Oh, my question is, when we have Pat making the Starman suit, because in the earlier conversation, Sylvester says, I don't even have my suit, right? That obviously Pat was like, you're right. And also, maybe if you are going to do stupid stuff like blow up grocery stores, maybe you shouldn't be wearing your regular clothes. Maybe you should be wearing a costume.
I don't get why Pat is doing this.
Because he loves Sylvester at the end of the
day.
I know.
It's like a toxic relationship.
It's really hard for him.
But what makes it weird is that it's framed where like Mike is in the doorway watching him.
That's the thing that I wanted to ask. Did he have something to say to Pat and then he didn't? And then, so is this like
the way that I interpreted it was that Mike was proud of his father
for
helping out a friend.
Yeah.
Which he shouldn't be proud of his father working with Sylvester.
No,
should allow himself to be less of an ass with Jakeem. That is what he should be taking
he
away.
He should. But that's not exactly how I pictured that. I kind of saw that as Mike overheard maybe some of the fight that was happening downstairs, since he's been doing a lot of eavesdropping today. And sure. He's proud of the fact that, like, he actually, even though he doesn't like the Crocs, that, like, he knows that his dad did something good with Stripe, which is, like, the one thing he's been waiting for. It's like, my dad's not, you know, he's glad to see that his dad stood up for himself. I think that's the thing that maybe, and I don't really know, but to me, I was kind of wondering if Mike actually, it had nothing to do with that necessarily, and it was more of Mike was going to talk to him about something or ask him something, and then he saw that he was doing something, and he was like, maybe not now. But the only reason why I say that is because I feel like they're just about to give Mike something, because we know he has a scene in next episode.
He's gonna partner up with Cindy close enough.
He's gonna partner with Cindy, and they have something with, he has something with Jakeem, whatever's happening.
Well,
next
he always
episode.
Has something with Jakeem.
I know.
So yeah,
I know. But also, and then also the other thing specifically is that I'm curious, because we've had it set up that Mike and Sylvester are kind of not exactly too buddy buddy. We had Sylvester visit what may literally be Mike's mom last season.
Yes, I'm pretty sure it is.
I'm pretty sure it is too, right? And so there is that. It hasn't been mentioned yet, but I feel like it should be at some point. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, just going through these ending other things. Cindy is still with the laptop. She's still not making any progress. She's still frustrated. We get a Mr. Bones cameo.
We do.
You know, because he has his little gloves, because he has like that cyanide touch or whatever. He's watching through all the monitors. I don't think that there were any new monitors.
I didn't even see like Beth's house. I could be wrong. I could have been there and I didn't notice.
No,
it.
There was Beth's house. Oh, yeah? You could see her parents in the monitor.
Really?
They were doing something.
I was looking. I couldn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you could see it was her parents. And then you have Sylvester at the crime scene and he is picked up.
Yeet upwards.
Just like an alien invasion. And when he's brought back down, his eyes are bleeding, which implied to me that he was like, maybe not necessarily blinded, but somebody definitely was like attacking his eyes, hoping that he doesn't get a good vision of whoever his assailant is. And he's pretty much worse for wear, but we know from the stills next episode that he's going to be sent to the hospital.
Somewhat so he'll be, like, sent to the hospital, fine. But also okay, because he looks okay.
Well, in the hospital scene, he doesn't. But no, in the scene
later, like with So yeah, that's the episode. Yeah.
You can follow the show at Star Squadcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Twitter. You can follow me, Cameron, at Ice Hour Night. Yeah, singular. I can never remember. Ice Hour Night on Twitter or Blue Valley Breaking News on Tumblr.
And I'm Tam, and you can follow me on That Killer Vibe on Instagram or TKV Hour Night. See, now I have no dash on Twitter or Hour Nights, and this is with an S, on Tumblr.
Thank you so much for listening. We will not see you. Well, we'll
you
never
will
see
you.
You
will be hearing us next week.
Sure, next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.